Hi, I'm Gordon Lanthier, and welcome to the Real Finds podcast, where we have real conversations with key entrepreneurs, activists, and researchers shaping the real estate industry and, as a result, our world. On today's podcast, we'll be speaking with Cliff Booth. Cliff is founder and chairman of Westmount Realty Capital, private Dallas-based owner-operator specializing in value-add, opportunistic, and core-plus investments. On the podcast, we discuss Westmount's 45 million square foot industrial, office, and multifamily portfolio, their investment thesis, their strategy driving effective site selection, and take a deep dive into their hottest asset class, cold storage, including effective steps to grow and scale a cold storage portfolio. If you're interested in the industrial asset class, especially cold storage, today's podcast is well worth a listen. Cliff, thanks for hopping on the podcast today.
My pleasure, Gordon. Appreciate the opportunity.
So why real estate? I'm sure you could have done a lot of things. What got you into the real estate business?
Jeez. At this point, it's in my blood for a long time. Some exposure to real estate through my family. My father and grandfather were in the antiques and art business in Montreal, Canada, and they were modest real estate investors on the side. So I was aware of real estate. When we moved from Montreal to Dallas in the late 70s, we bought a property to house our antique and art gallery. That was my first real estate deal. The antique and art business did not go that great, but the real estate that we acquired did well. So I'm not a rocket scientist, but I kind of paid attention to that.
I've been doing it. So look, real estate can be an art form sometimes. And I think what you guys have done over at Westmount is been pretty artful. I'm curious, what was your investment thesis and kind of how has that evolved?
Yeah, just as a follow-up to the one thing that's similar between antiques and real estate, every piece is unique. There might be many similarities between two antiques or two pieces of real estate, but every one of them is unique. So that was, I don't know how profound that is, but I just thought I'd say that. The thesis, I guess in today's vernacular, you'd call it value add, maybe opportunistic. We were always looking for opportunities where we could add value, right? So not so much looking for the buildings that had stable cash flow. Was much more looking for the ones that had potential where we saw that we could do something that somebody else wasn't doing, let's say, or that you were buying. You know, I'd like to think, you know, when I think about Warren Buffett when he says buying a good company at a fair price, right? Not necessarily like the way he says it. If you buy a lousy company at a great price, that's not such a great idea. It's probably better to buy, you know, a better piece of real estate at a fair price. Not, you don't have to steal it. You know, once in a while you might get lucky, but the thesis was more trying to buy real estate that had the basic, you know, attributes to it, location, the bones, whatever else, and do something more with it than what was currently being done.
And so I know you mentioned kind of finding opportunities, and I'm curious, like, where do you find kind of those opportunities, and what are the biggest opportunities that you look for in a building?
I will say that we've been doing this for over 40 years. It's way, way harder to find them today than it was. It's just the nature of the beast. There's more players. There's more capital. There's more transparency. Information that you had used to be something that gave you an edge in certain situations. Everybody's got the same information right now, you know. So it's just a lot of elbow grease, a lot of relationship building, a lot of focus. I don't think there's anything magic to it, right? You know, it's just you. Well, maybe the magic or secret sauce to it is sort of, you know, seeing something or recognizing, like, maybe there's something here. Or I mentioned a second ago, relationship building. So, you know, you can't possibly focus on every deal that you see. So you focus on the ones where you know the broker, you know the seller, you're in that market, so you can kind of speed up your underwriting or get more comfortable, possibly get more aggressive. So, you know, trying to use what's in front of you, what's available to you, which those things were always true, but they become more important now because of what I was saying, how competitive the environment is.
So when we're talking about a competitive environment, one of the environments that I think has become increasingly competitive and also increasingly profitable is cold storage. So kind of what got you into the cold storage space in the first place?
Kind of got into it by accident a long time ago. Probably it was in the 80s. We owned a small building in Dallas, 11,000 square foot building, that the tenant moved out, and the new tenant who was coming in wanted to convert it to refrigerator. It was not freezer at that time. He wasn't, and I didn't have any idea. I mean, of course, I knew that the cold storage existed, but I had no exposure to it. And this guy put in refrigerators, and he did one thing. Just indulge me here for a second. He had cabbage, lettuce, carrots, and onions, I think, were the four products coming into the docks. He had these massive shredding machines, and at the other end of those shredding machines was these big garbage bags. And the product would go in, and he'd load up these garbage bags, and they would ship them to hospital cafeterias, school and university cafeterias, corporate cafeterias, restaurants, hotels, etc. And I was like, what? That's what you do? And that's all he did. He had two or three shifts a day and would just plug out this stuff. And so it was a bit of an eye-opener for me. And then sort of over time, you know, we started doing others. And then I, you know, started to realize what an interesting and ever-expanding. Interesting. Now it's so specialized. There's everything you can imagine: ripening rooms, and chocolates, and flowers, and food prep of various different kinds, freezer and cooler, and freezing proteins, freezing vegetables, lunchables, barbecue sauce. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. So it's juice boxes. I mean, so it's and now I think it was always pretty vibrant and active. COVID really made that more so.
So one of the things that I know you mentioned is it's a vibrant and active space. And I think there's a tremendous amount of demand in most markets for it, particularly markets like the Chicagoland area, where, you know, we have a lot of food and a lot of cold storage users. I'm curious, as part of that, one of the things that's kind of not kept up with demand is the supply. And I'm curious, why do you think it's been particularly hard to build and scale cold storage?
So there's a couple of things there. Firstly, most of the cold storage space in the U.S. is owned by users. So they occupy or build for their own account, number one. Number two, I think the figure 77% of the space in the U.S. was built before the year 2000, much of it even way before then. Added to that it's a fair bit more expensive to build cold stores than it is to build regular dry warehouses. So because it's not as well known, because it's more expensive, and because most of it is occupied by users, there's a lot of developers who will shy away from it, understandably, and so you have a market for the, you know, so the built to suit, but what we're doing is building speculatively. We will do built to suits as well, but I think people in some cases are nervous about, well, what if it doesn't lease? How do you convert it back to dry space? My personal opinion, that's kind of the wrong question. You're probably not going to do that. I mean, we're building, you know, 50-foot clear buildings, right? The food tenants are in the cubic business. They're not in the per square foot business. So by going up higher, the space is a lot more efficient for them. But the difference is maybe, you know, in Dallas, it's different in different areas of the country. It's the difference between building at $200 a foot or $300 a foot, plus or minus. It is quite different. And so if you're looking at it as a, you know, for your risk profile, you can get higher rents, but, you know, there's some expertise that's required and there's some risk. So some people look at it and say, well, it's not worth the risk, which is a fair comment. It's not the road that we're choosing, but I understand it.
So when we're talking about risk and talking about a value add, ultimately, one of the biggest things that we hear and we talk about on this podcast is site selection. So how are you choosing sites for speculative development and kind of what are the factors at play?
Yeah, very important question, very important issue to us. Not necessarily to everybody who's building, but it is for us. So in the decades that we have been owning industrial and not just cold storage, we have focused on infill, close-in product. That is, if you look at our portfolio, most of it is properties that are near airports, near or on freeways, not a lot of land around it. And that's been a successful strategy for us in industrial in general. And we've taken that same strategy to cold storage. We believe that there's a market for, call it last mile cold storage, especially as I was saying, post COVID. So people want more food choices quicker and closer to them, right? So if you think about your own grocery store in the last 5 to 10 years, they may or may not have had a salad bar 5 or 10 years ago. They definitely have more prepared food, perhaps a salad bar. Most grocery stores, at the price of that real estate and labor and everything else, they don't prepare all that food on site. They might prepare some of it, but not all of it. There's a market there for cold storage to do a lot of that. So I said food prep for those kind of things to send to all kinds of, you know, a grocery store. So our belief is that by catering to those tenants who want to be closer in, not just for the food prep, for many other things as well, but that gives you a sort of flavor. We believe that's actually the primary tenet of our cold storage strategy is infill locations.
Yeah, one of the difficulties that we found with infill locations, and I'm sure you can educate us on this, and how it plays into your strategy, is finding adequate power. Because power, I know there's some people who are less familiar that are investors listening might not understand it, but it's not always as easy as just putting in a little additional transformer on the block. It can be a little bit more difficult than that. And even if you are putting in a transformer, it can be incredibly expensive. How do you go about the process of looking at site location when you're factoring in power?
Yeah, it's definitely something that you have to be cognizant of. It's one of those things, again, you know, decades ago, power, you took it for granted. There was power in the area, then you're fine. I will say cold storage is not a consumer of power the way data buildings are, for example. Yeah. So it's not as much of a issue. We have not had to, pass on a site, let's say, because of lack of power, but it's certainly on the checklist of things that you get to pretty quickly. Yeah. It's an important factor.
It's just money, right? It's just money. So
it's just money, but I will say that it's very, very difficult, again, back to the competitive environment, to find a good infill site. It's very competitive. The prices have gone high in any major city, and it is what it is.
So when we're talking about what it is, you know, it's a complex process, right? So what are the ultimate, besides power, keys to designing and delivering a cold storage space?
Ingress and egress, because you've got velocity of trucking and delivery. You have to design your site. It has to make economic sense, right? But in terms of how big the building is versus how much extra parking and trailer storage you're going to have, that's become increasingly a very important issue. Visibility. I would say also ability to get employees to your site. You know, the employee issues across the country are just become more and more prominent. So you don't want to have a site in an area where the employees have to drive too far or can't get to it. Or even, you know, we prefer to have sites on freeways. If you're going to be off the freeway, not too far from a freeway, the road that is not on the freeway, perhaps, to get to your site, you know, has to be paved, has to be wide enough. Trucks can waste a lot of time. If it takes 20 minutes to get, you know, from the freeway to your site, well, 20 minutes each way is 40 minutes per car. That becomes a pretty significant expense. So those are the kind of things.
So when we're talking about expenses, one of the big things that folks worry about are overruns and cost overruns. And this could be particularly true for an expensive product, be it a data center or cold storage. So I'm curious, how do you guys protect against cost overruns and mitigate potential cost overrun risk?
Yeah. So the way we're doing it is that we interview general contractors, we choose a general contractor, we negotiate an arrangement for the general contractor's fee. And then after that, we lock arms with the contractor and everything else is open book, right? He knows what he's going to make. We see all the bids from the subs. We negotiate them with the general contractor. And then we have a sharing agreement with the general contractor on cost savings. So we actually hope it goes the other way. Because he's got those kind of incentives to make sure that happens. And we'll make sure that's a generous agreement to motivate the end result that we want to see.
Yeah, it's always a good thing when you can align incentives.
Sticky.
In terms of that and kind of aligning incentives, one of the things that I'd love to kind of dive into is investment strategy and like kind of your long-term viewpoints on kind of aligning incentives of creating great spaces that work for the consumer and kind of how the consumer is changing. How has your strategy changed over the last 5 or so years with cold storage? Have you seen a big shift or is the consumer very similar to the consumer, 5 or even 10 years ago?
So a couple things on that. First of all, the buildings have gotten a lot more sophisticated. Like I said, now, you know, people were building maybe 30 or 40 feet. Now it's 50 feet. I've heard buildings even 70 or 100 feet in specialized situations where we're generally okay with 50 feet now. And when I say 50 foot clear, the building's actually 70 foot, but it's 50 foot clear to allow for the equipment in the last 20 feet. There's been a great expansion of the types of tenants that go in these buildings. So, robotics, sophisticated racking systems, how much freezer versus how much cooler. Now that the buildings are more better built and able to accommodate more. The products that people can freeze, you know, we didn't used to freeze vegetables, for example. We just used to freeze meat and fish, you know, all the proteins. But now we're actually freezing vegetables. And you'll see, for example, we've had tenants that will buy, you know, the sort of proverbial, I'm speculating on pork bellies, you know, yeah, in the market. Well, what some we've seen some people do, they buy beef or pork or whatever in the summer when maybe the price is better to buy, deep freeze it for the Thanksgiving and Christmas season. So there's just a lot of things that have gone, you know, like anything as it evolves, there's more iterations, there's more ingenuity that comes with it. There's a greater variety of products. You know, I don't think I mentioned, but ripening rooms, you know, avocado ripening rooms, banana ripening rooms, flowers is a big part. I mean, you should see these places on, you know, Valentine's Day and Mother's Day and chocolates. I mean, it's fascinating to watch. Pretty quiet the rest of the year, but yeah. So I don't know if I fully answered your question there, but
yeah, I think you did. You know, I know we could dive into that a little bit more, but I'd love to kind of get away from cold storage for a bit and talk about just what you're seeing in the industrial market as a whole. I mean, cold storage is a very promising market, but industrial has been generally pretty promising as well. So I'm curious, what do you see the state of the industrial market like right now, nationally and maybe even in some of the submarkets that you guys are highly active in?
Yeah. So we've been in industrial since the inception of the company, so over 40 years. Other products as well, especially multifamily. Our portfolio is about two-thirds industrial, one-third multifamily by design. Over the last few years, when interest rates crept up rather precipitously, we fortunately did not see much distress in our industrial portfolio. We bought a bit, we sold a bit, you know, volumes not as much as we historically or traditionally have done in the years before that. Operationally, we're high 90s across the country, occupied, not just us, our peer groups are the same. Rent growth has been, you know, very strong, you know, less strong in certain markets where they traditionally are less strong and stronger, and the ones you'd probably expect would be stronger, but pretty great everywhere. So the industrial space is really head up. It used to be the poor stepchild of the real estate business. If you look at the major food groups over the years, it was the Rodney Dangerfield, the one no respect. But for the last, you know, at least five plus years, it's definitely gotten the respect, and deservedly so, in my opinion. So now there's a lot of capital that's come to it, and hence the competitive nature of it. Most of the money that's come into the space is still for bulk distribution space. You know, I have these conversations probably almost weekly with a new sort of foreign investor who's interested in industrial. You can see the thought bubble above their head being an Amazon building. We don't own Amazon buildings. Not that there's anything wrong with them. It's just back to my earlier comment. There's not really levers to pull. You know, you're buying. If you buy Amazon, you have a single tenant. You have a bunch of term, many years left on the lease. You're just kind of waiting to see what happens at the end of that lease. So that's not really our play. Our play is more multi-tenant and buildings where there's more levers to pull to create value. But I think there's some kind of misconception about, you know, industrial space that, you know, you just go to the mailbox and get the rent check every month, which, I mean, there's a little bit of truth to that, but it's not the whole truth. And so the good news about industrial versus, let's say, office or even retail or multifamily, that they're triple net rents, right? And so you need to be a good landlord and keep your costs down. Otherwise, you're not going to be competitive. And people will know that. Tenants will know that. Leasing brokers will know that. Tenant rep brokers as well. So you need to be really on your game and be a good steward of your investment for all the right reasons. But at the same time, if those costs do go up, the way we've seen insurance costs the last few years, those are primarily shouldered by the tenant because those triple net rents. So it's not the same in multifamily, right? Those insurance costs go up and there's only so much you can pass along. So I think people become aware of that, investors, and it's given a lot more reason for industrial to shine and for people to be attracted to it. And even things like during COVID, right, where the government said you can't evict someone who doesn't pay. You know, as landlords, we were all patient, and I'm speaking on the industrial side, with tenants, but we didn't have that many tenants who came to us for forbearance. We had a few, but really it was a very small minority of tenants. But in multifamily, you know, it was quite disruptive. So all those things, I think, kind of come into it, and I'm not beating up on multifamily. We're still in that business, and we'll continue to be in the business. I'm just sort of highlighting what I think has occurred in the last few years. Industrial, the CapEx requirements, the biggest CapEx issues in industrial are roofs. And, you know, that's a significant cost, and you need to be really aware of what the condition of the roof is when you buy the property. And one of the things we've learned is that you can extend the life of a roof through good maintenance. And sometimes we see that landlords are not, you know, whether it's fixing blisters and, you know, repairing them before they get worse, or even just gutters, you know, making sure the runoff is good. So what we charge our team to do is, when we buy a property, we say, well, how long do you think that this roof will last? And if they say 3 years or 5 years, now once we own the property, so, well, can you beat it? And so that's what we endeavor to do.
So speaking of roof maintenance, is that an aspect of the business that you would charge your team to do, and you wouldn't hold the tenant accountable? I know for us, we've long held the position for our management team that we always do HVAC. Like, we don't let the tenant get near it. We'll just charge them. And we found that by doing that, we can extend the useful life of units sometimes a decade extra. Yeah. I'm curious, is that kind of your similar philosophy for roofs as well?
Yeah, it is. But generally, it goes by, I mean, you're inheriting a bunch of leases, then you're writing new leases for tenants that you might inherit leases that say different things. I would say the general industry standard has been that maintenance is a part of a tenant expense. Replacement is a landlord expense.
So in terms of expenses, one of the other things that I know you mentioned was insurance. And I'm curious, you know, we've all seen insurance go up in the industry. It's been crazy, right, in the last 5 years. Are there ways that we can lower that cost as a landlord in the industrial space? Or do you think that we're just going to have to weather the storm?
Yes, there are things we can do, and yes, we're going to have to weather the storm. It's both. But the things that I would say that we can do are, one, we've gotten a lot closer, not just to our insurance agents, but to the actual markets who are writing the checks for our insurance. And we've been doing this for a while. We have a group of people internally, and I'm part of that sometimes. We go to London, New York, Bahamas, where the groups are, and we talk to them. We find out what their needs are. We tell them what we do to maintain our buildings, to mitigate risk. So that's one relationship part of it. Two, I'd say the insurance companies are built around, they understand what they call catastrophic events, right? That's in none of our control. and they build that into their numbers, and they don't like it, but it is what it is. They have to pay when there's that catastrophe. What they don't like is what they call death by a thousand cuts. They don't like when landlords like you and us turn in every little small claim because, well, I have insurance. So we're sort of cognizant of trying to manage that to be a better partner with our insurance companies. And I'd say then the third is just to you know, the nuts and bolts of the business, to actually do what you say you're going to do, is be a really good landlord and maintain and watch your buildings. And the fourth thing is the balancing of your portfolio. So the insurance companies don't like concentration risk. They might say, we don't like Florida because of the hurricanes. Maybe they don't want you to have too much in Houston, whatever the issues are of the day, or California. So we try and sort of, when we're buying something, or as we're deciding where our growth is going to be, we're trying to think that through in terms of how that's balancing the size of our portfolio. And in our case, balancing with our multifamily portfolio well, which is a whole other beast on the insurance side.
So I know we could get into that whole other beast, but I think we're going to get into our final four. And our final four is always a great way to kind of wrap up the podcast, learn a little bit more about you and kind of where you see the market going in general. So I'm curious, and this is one of my favorite questions, where do you think you're going to see cold storage and industrial space 10 years from now?
I think it's going to continue to grow. I think speculative building will be more accepted and understood. For us, that's good news and bad news. I don't want it to be too accepted. I'd like it to remain not as competitive, but a little bit more understanding would probably be helpful. I think there'll be. I didn't mention this too much, but we're also building our buildings where they could be multi-tenant and not just single-tenant. A lot of cold storage buildings have been built around the idea that they will be occupied by one tenant. Ours can be two, but we're also designing them so that they can be multi-tenant. We believe that there's a really, and that's, I don't want to get too far afield, but we think there's a pretty robust market for smaller tenants within the cold storage space.
No, I would love to get into that. So we've had several investors we've worked with our management company and our brokerage company, that's been a prime part of their thesis. They've tried to avoid large single tenant buildings. And I'll say this definitively, you know, I'm fourth generation as a broker. So, you know, you see when things go up and down and the markets go up, big single tenant buildings are great, but on the downswing, sometimes they can be absolutely catastrophic for a portfolio. So how have you kind of applied the multi-tenant thesis to the cold storage world? And like, what do you look for in a building?
Well, first thing is that we're now developing the buildings. We're most of the time buying existing buildings, and they were all multi-tenant buildings, or we converted dry spaces. So we bought a couple of times, you know, very large properties, a million plus square foot, that were multi-tenant, some cold, some dry. And then we converted some dry to cold. We then raised ceilings and things like that. So pretty hands-on, heavy-duty repositioning. But now that we're building from scratch, ground up, we're designing the buildings. And there's specific things you have to do with the flooring and, you know, otherwise, to make sure that you can divide. Because we're profiling that those type of tenants. And I just believe that there's a significant market. There's a lot of reasons why those tenants want to control their own spaces. As I was saying earlier, a lot of the spaces they're in right now are quite old, inefficient, older energy management systems. And even they're mostly right now, they're in the public warehouse systems, right? So pulling them out, they have a financial incentive because they have to pay the public warehouses. Every time the public warehouser touches their pallet for all the various line items, they have a markup on it. That's their business, to make a profit. If they lease their own space. Not only do they control their own destiny, but they can perform all those services to themselves at cost instead of paying a profit to someone else.
So one of the things that we're sometimes someone else too is our previous self. And I'm curious if you could step back in time and look at a young Cliff and say, hey, when you're coming out of school, here's one little bit of advice. What would it be?
Be a sponge and specialize. I would say, you know, we were in for a long, long time. We were, I would call us a deal shop, right? We were not as committed. We are always probably strongest in industrial, but if we saw a great retail center, we did a lot of retail. We don't now. We were buying office buildings. We're probably not that interested in office buildings, though today, just as a footnote, you know, in San Francisco where the market's down or some other markets, we are actually looking at office. But specialization and whatever it are, if you're a broker, if you're a if you want to be on the equity side, debt side, whatever part, appraisal, whatever, pick a specialty and become great at it. That's what I believe. We're in the world of specialization, and the more you can specialize, the more you can add value to whoever you're doing business with, to yourself, to your company. I think that's the name of the game now. Because if you're a generalist right now, I think those days are, you know, largely gone.
So one of the ways that we like to add value is we like to add value on this podcast by finding books that our listeners might be interested in. So I'm curious, do you have a book recommendation for?
Yeah, I'd have to think. It's probably not going to be a real estate book.
That's fine.
Yeah, boy. I don't know why this is coming to my head. It's completely off topic. It has nothing to do with that, anything we're talking about. I'm reading a book. What's her name? The historian. I just can't remember her name. She's around Pulitzer Prizes. I'll think of it and you can mention it at the end of the podcast.
We'll put it in the comments. But there's one thing that we won't let you get away with, and that's the whole reason for the podcast is we firmly believe that the men and women in the arena tend to know the next person that we should be speaking to. So I'm curious, who's the next voice we should have on the podcast?
On any real estate topic.
Any real estate topic.
Jeez, I should have prepared for these questions, Gordon. there's so many interesting people. What would be timely today? You know, there's a lot of smart people out there. Do you know, there's a guy named Craig Hall?
I've heard the name. Yeah. Craig
Hall is a very interesting person. Had his ups and had his downs, a lot more ups than downs. Major developer in the Dallas area. Also owns wineries and all kinds of other things. I think he could be a very interesting person for your audience.
Well, I'd love to.
Industrial at all. Not an industrial guy.
I'd love to reach out nonetheless. I mean, I find on the podcast that we get sometimes the best advice from areas that are outside of the asset classes of our traditional listeners or outside of the asset classes that I specialize in. So I think cross-pollination is a real real advantage sometimes. And in terms of that, you know, if somebody wants to reach out and get some cross-pollination, or just someone who's in the world of commercial real estate that's maybe more near and dear to your portfolio, what's the best way to get in contact?
Yeah, go on our website. My email address is there, and happy to connect.
Cliff, thank you so much, and we have to have you on in the future.
Thanks, Gordon. Really appreciate it.
Thanks again to Cliff. We appreciate his insights. And if you enjoy the podcast, please give us a like, a 5-star rating, and a review. Your comments, interactions, and subscriptions truly matter and help us to continue to get quality guests. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gordon Lanphier with the Real Finds Podcast, and thank you for listening.